Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. This is going to be an interesting show and a unique show in that we're not going to have a show. We're actually going to talk about the Jazz on the Tube podcast. We're doing that because last time we put out a podcast, we hit a really important milestone. It was show number 50. And when you consider that there was no plan, no funding, and the whole thing is managed on the back of an envelope, that's not bad. So we're going to talk about where we've been with the Jazz on the Tube podcast and where we're going and where we'd like to go. First, a little background on Jazz on the Tube. I keep forgetting the exact year that we started the thing, but I think it was 2009. So we're coming up – no, I think it was 2008 actually. So we're coming up on our 10th anniversary. And we were one of the very first, the first websites to put a lot of video jazz on the internet. And that was an accident of history. It was very hard to put video on the internet. And then suddenly somebody figured out how to do it relatively easily with something called a video embed code. And as soon as I saw that, I started gathering videos just for my own use because I love old jazz videos and new jazz videos. And then I put them together in a website, and I invited friends to join, and one thing led to another. And at one point, we had over 40,000 active email subscribers. Now, what's happened in recent years is as everybody's email box has gotten filled up, and video has become common on the internet, we don't have quite those numbers, but we still have one of the biggest email lists in the whole jazz world, which is a great asset, which I'm always trying to figure out what to do with. We started the podcasts like we start so many things just because we thought it would be interesting and something worth doing. And like I said, we're now up to 50 calls. We think there might be a possibility of getting the podcast to be self-supporting. And that's really important because these podcasts take a lot of work. I'm estimating to do it right, we put about 7 hours into each show. I would say an hour in prep, and that includes figuring out who to interview, reaching out to various people. Not everybody says yes. Not everybody even responds to their email, making the booking, and then about 2 hours doing the actual show itself, 2 hours on post-production, editing it so that it sounds good, and then the various technical things that have to be done to make people aware that the podcast exists. There are a whole bunch of other technical things that we could be doing to increase the reach of this podcast. Now, what that would mean in terms of listeners, I don't know. Maybe we would double our listeners. Maybe we would 10x our listeners. I really don't know. But that all leads to the most important issue, practical issue, which is paying for the thing. 7 hours is a lot of time. Multiply that by 50, and you got a whole lot of time. And while it is a labor of love and it's a lot of fun, that's a lot of hours to put in without any kind of support. So we do have a lot of great Jazz on the Tube supporters. If you're one of them, I greatly, greatly appreciate you, whether you're a one-time contributor or a monthly contributor. It's essential. We've got the server bills. We've got the email bills. I have to have a technical helper make all this stuff work for me. And it's a lot of money out of pocket. So it seems like it's going to be easier, knocking wood here, to get support and sponsorship for a successful podcast than it is for the website. We've worked pretty hard to get advertisers, and we have a great product, and we have more traffic than Downbeat. But what we don't have is a full-time dedicated staff of salespeople that can go through all the hoops of communicating that to the world. I tried it, and I just can't do it in the midst of all the other things that I do. So, but focused on a podcast, we might be a little bit luckier. So if you are a supporter of Jazz in the Tube, you are the person, you are among the people who make these podcasts possible. They absolutely would not and could not exist without your support, and so grateful for that. And you're not only paying your own way, you're also paying forward for others. I might estimate that about 1% of the people that heavily use Jazz in the Tube actually contribute. So you're supporting 99 other people. And our goal is to make this material available for free. I mean, that's what we do. It's not a goal. And we want to, that's our intention. And we want to continue to do that. The whole purpose of this is to help jazz lovers get more access to what they love. But our second purpose is to help educate people about jazz. I know there are a whole lot of people that are interested and curious about jazz, and they want to know more about it, and they're ready to get involved as fans, but they feel a little insecure because it's very hard to get an education about jazz these days. There's just not that many outlets for the general public like there used to be. I mean, there's Jazz Times and Downbeat, but that's for hardcore fans. And, you know, the vast majority of people out there are not hardcore fans, may never be hardcore fans, but they're interested, you know, and they could become fans, they could become supporters of the music, but somebody's got to help them in the door. And so that's the purpose of everything that we do, to entertain and hopefully delight existing fans, but also to help in the creation of new fans. And I don't think it's a whole hard thing to accomplish. In the olden days, there used to be a lot of jazz on television, and that helped a lot of people get entry into the world of jazz as fans and listeners. Not only were there television shows, but there used to be radio stations. And if you go way back, of course, there were lots of clubs and lots of bands playing live. And I believe all that can come back, and I actually see a great revival of jazz taking place. We have to thank our academic institutions for that. I'm amazed at how many jazz programs there are, and there's good and bad with everything, but I think it's really good that jazz is being respected to the point that you can, as a student at a college, get credit for learning about the music and playing the music, and that you can get playing opportunities now that playing opportunities don't exist in the same scale that they used to. But anyway, let's focus. So that's sort of the future. My dream is to get a lot of supporters, a lot of new supporters. And again, thank you to our current supporters. Can't do this without you. But to encourage people that love this music and are enjoying the website and the videos and now the podcasts to consider supporting it, not only because it's the right thing to do, but also because you're actually helping advance the music. I, as a point of contrast, I have a colleague that does a podcast. I have a lot of colleagues because I've been in the internet business since the early 90s, so I know lots of people that do internet things. And this guy, he's called the War Nerd, and he's an expert on all the intricate details of mayhem and warfare. And every week he does a 2.5-hour show with a co-host. And those fellows collect $10,000 a month from their listeners. That would be really nice. Now, I'm not expecting that, and I don't need that to do what I do, but it just shows you what's possible. So my question is, are there at least as many people interested in beauty and art, music, as there are in mayhem? I don't know. I guess over the next several months and years, we'll find out. But this is a pitch. If you've been listening to these podcasts, they don't fall from the sky. They take a lot of time, money. I mean, there's outflow of money to make these things in addition to the time. And your support as a Jazz in the Tube supporter supports the podcasts. So let's look at where we've been, and I'm actually kind of amazed at where we've been. First of all, the 50 shows, I just counted them last week, and it's like, wow, that's a lot of shows. I want to go through the shows, some of the highlight shows. They all have qualities that are worthwhile. Some of them have been, I think, truly amazing, and that has to do with the guests, of course. Let's go working backwards. Last week, we interviewed Judy Carmichael, and Judy Carmichael is one of the reigning pros of stride piano. She's also a vocalist and a lyricist and a band leader and an author and a producer, and she does all kinds of things. She also has the best jazz interview show going. It's right up there. Now, Marion McPartland, of course, is no longer with us, So that's why I can say Judy's show is the best live ongoing show, and it is of equal quality to what Marion McPartland did. It is fantastic. And we did an extended interview with her, and we talked about a lot of different things. And one of the interesting things to me about Judy is, how did a blonde teenage girl from Southern California growing up in the 60s become one of the world's most esteemed stride piano players? And there's a lesson in that story, and Judy and I talked about it. And we're also going to have a part two with Judy, because she's got so much to talk about because of her work interviewing people, interviewing other musicians. And Judy takes an approach that we take. It's kind of a no-brainer to go out and find celebrities and interview them, especially when they have something to promote. It takes a little bit more work and more thought to interview I would call the foot soldiers of jazz. You know, people that aren't, you know, superstars, but they're amazing players, they're amazing contributors, they have amazing stories, they have important things to say, but they're not, quote, famous. You probably hurt your distribution by not focusing on the stars, but I don't know, the stars get enough attention, you know, and there's a lot of people doing a lot of great work that should get more attention than they get. So that's our model. And that's not to say that Judy or I don't interview people with big names occasionally, and it's not to say those people aren't interesting or worthy. They certainly are. But we skew heavily towards interviewing people that may not famous. And Judy and I talked about that whole issue of famous versus not famous. And unfortunately, I'd say it is unfortunate. Our society puts way too much emphasis on celebrity and fame as evidence of worth. And the dark side of that is, if somebody isn't famous or doesn't have massive celebrity, the average person doesn't know enough to perk up their ears and listen and make up their own mind about where the quality is. So that's the focus of our shows. We want interesting people that are saying interesting things about jazz. The other thing about Judy, too, that's so interesting, and I hope everybody has a chance to listen to the show. If you haven't, definitely check it out, is this issue of old versus contemporary jazz. And it's very strange to me that if you go to in the classical world, you might go to a program and there'll be some Bach, there'll be some Beethoven, there'll be some Debussy, there'll be some Stravinsky. And nobody says, "Oh, Bach, oh my God, that stuff's so old. You know, get with it. Get some modern music on this. You know, why are you even playing that stuff? Mozart, oh my God, he's like old hat." And yet in the jazz world, people do that. They'll go, "What? Stride piano? That's kind of corny. That's kind of old school." You know, and I think there's a great grave mistake there. That music was worthy then, and it's worthy now. We don't want to just play and listen to stride piano. That would be a little odd, but there's no reason to throw the music of the 20s and the 30s and the 40s out the window, because there's new music. And I understand, you know, new musicians, current generation needs exposure, and they, you know, they deserve exposure, but they also have to go out and earn it. You don't just say, "Hey, I'm a new composer. Forget Mozart, forget Bach, and just listen to me." That doesn't work. So yeah, new compositions, new composers, new players certainly merit and deserve our attention. But there's no reason to throw out the old stuff and not study it, because those guys were really good, and they kind of create a foundation, a touchstone of quality. And I really think they're the measure of new music. Now, the music may sound completely different, maybe coming from a completely different place, but in terms of musicianship and quality and the musicians listening to each other and ensemble work, well, those are still the standards. And when you go back and you listen to the old music, those guys hit really, really, really high standards. And there's no reason for us to discount or throw them out. And I do see that there is a trend, especially encouragingly among young people, to appreciate, you know, the older swing bands, swing music, music from the 20s, small ensemble groups. You see a lot of that in New Orleans, but you see it actually all over the world now. I just heard a band from Mexico City that plays Fats Waller. You know, I think that's a great thing. So anyway, check out the call with Judy. She's a fascinating person, and we got into some really good subjects. Before the call with Judy, we did an interview with a guy named Al Jackson. And Al is the proprietor of the Petit Tremé Jazz Museum, which is what it says it is. It's a petite museum. It's small. It's in Tremé, which is one of the most important historical districts in the entire United States. And it's focused on jazz. And Al, in particular, focuses on the origins of jazz. And it's convenient that he's in New Orleans because, of course, we all understand that New Orleans is one of the places where jazz began. It's not the only place, but it's one of the most important places. And he goes into all the elements. And that's the other theme of our podcast is we're trying to understand not who's hot or who's a celebrity today. And you can get Downbeat for that or Jazz Times. We're trying to understand the music at a deep level. We're trying to understand where it came from, what its influences are, what elements make it up. We also talk a lot about musicians themselves and how they develop from young students to masters. You know, all the things that go into making the art, because we're looking for clues. You know, we're looking for clues to try to understand how did this amazing music even come to be in the first place. And it is amazing music. It's not just a niche hobby. This is an incredible art form. It's incredible for its vitality, for its creativity, for its adaptability, for its ability to absorb influences. There are many great musical art forms in the world, and I'm interested in all those too. But they don't have the same capacity to adapt and to change and to absorb influences. Jazz just takes it all in, digests it, and creates something amazing from it. So to talk about that in inquiry into all those elements that go into jazz, I think is very important. And Al is one of the reigning authorities on all, I call the influences, 30th parallel and below. That would include, of course, New Orleans. That would include Cuba. That would include Mexico. That would include a lot of places that don't get credit for making important, essential contributions to jazz. Did you know that the saxophone came to New Orleans via Mexico? Most people don't, but it did. And there's hundreds of stories like that. Al also focuses on the Creole contribution, the New Orleans Afro-Creole contribution to jazz. And that's something that's not really well appreciated or well understood. Who were these Afro-Creoles and why were they so important? And we get into that in great depth in the call. We also talked about Louis Armstrong and who's the grandfather of us all. You know, I mean, it's you take Louis Armstrong out of the equation and jazz kind of falls apart. And it's just how it is. And what's very strange, and Al and I addressed this in the call, is after Mr. Armstrong died, not while he was alive, but after he was gone and wasn't there to defend himself, all this BS started coming out about him. Number one, well, he wasn't really born on the 4th of July. That was just, he made that up. Well, you know what? There's no evidence that he made that up. Somebody produced a piece of paper, literally a scrap of paper, that has his name on it, that has a different date. Well, you know, anybody can manufacture a scrap of paper. And who even knows what that scrap of paper signified? It's very bizarre. It's a very bizarre tale. There is no baptismal certificate, formal or informal, baptismal certificate for Louis Armstrong. It doesn't appear in any church record in New Orleans. Now, the Catholic churches were very diligent, and they still are, but they especially were in the old days. If they baptized someone, that record was kept and you could find it. Well, you cannot find a formal baptismal certificate for Louis Armstrong. You also can't find a birth certificate. Now, that's not unusual. There are millions and millions of people born in the United States in the olden times who never had a birth certificate. So there is no document that says Louis Armstrong was born on August 4th. No verifiable, a valid document. It does not exist. Now, Louis Armstrong's mother said that he was a firecracker baby. Well, When do people light off firecrackers? They don't light off firecrackers on August 4th. When Louis Armstrong registered for the draft, which he did, he put down his birthday as July 4th, 1900. There were other times in his life when he had to fill out formal documents, and he put down that birth date. So why people have come along after the fact and doubted his veracity, I don't know. But that's something that Al and I get into. We also get into the myth that he never returned to New Orleans, that he abandoned his city, that he got into some kind of a snit and never came back, only came back on a few rare occasions. Well, that's not true. Al has the ledger for the what they called in those days the Negro Musicians Union. Louis Armstrong was a union member, and he, in fact, did come back at least 14 times. Al doesn't have the entire ledger of the entire history of New Orleans. He only has about 12 years. But in those 12 years, Louis Armstrong came back to New Orleans 14 times for official gigs. So where this mythology came along that he got into a thing and, you know, decided to abandon his hometown, nonsense. Third thing, and this I think is the most despicable, is if you read a lot of bios of Louis Armstrong, casual bios, they all say, oh, his mother was a prostitute. There's no evidence that she was a prostitute. No evidence at all. And she was a resident of a boarding house in a rough part of town, which is if you don't have much money, that's where you're going to be living. And that was a common living arrangement for many, many people. And how that jumps to the idea that his mother was a prostitute was quite a leap. There is no evidence of her working in a brothel. There's no evidence of her working in a crib. There's no arrest records. There's nothing like that. So where this comes from, I don't know. But all of these things came up after he passed away and was not in a position to speak to them. I've spoke a lot about that because this bothers me. And if we have done nothing else in our podcast, we put on the record that these things are dubious at best and fraudulent at worst. And I want to put out a clarion call to everybody in the jazz world to talk this up and to create some pressure on these people who disseminate this baloney, this slanderous baloney, to cut it out. If you can't come forward with a birth certificate, if you can't come forward with some kind of clear documentary evidence of any of these claims, shut up. You have no basis to say these things. So anyway, passion put aside. All right. Previous to interviewing Al, we interviewed Jack Sullivan, who's a professor at Rider University. He writes about classical music and opera, and he's also a jazz fanatic and loves New Orleans, has been going every winter since, I think, 90. And he opened my eyes to something that I was only vaguely aware of, which is how important classical music, in particular opera, was in the creation of jazz and the fact that Louis Armstrong was a big opera fan. Now, that doesn't mean he had a tuxedo and was able to go in and sit in the orchestra seats, but you could hang out outside and you could hear, and people learned the songs and people sang the songs, and opera was in the air. And there are many New Orleans musicians who say that basically one person came out, I think it was one of the Batiste brothers, and just said, sorry, John Boutte, great New Orleans singer, maybe the best. He just flat out said, opera is the grandfather of jazz. Now, this is kind of cataclysmic stuff here. Whoever heard of that? Whoever talked about that before? You know, when people say, well, jazz is America's classical music, and it's almost like patting jazz on the head and saying, gee, you're almost as good as a classical music. Well, you know what? Anybody that knows music knows that when it comes to chops and musicianship and understanding, the average jazz musician is at least as accomplished as the average classical musician. And without taking anything away from people that play classical and classical only, I would say a superior musician. You can't give a classically trained musician a fake book and have them create 100 different variations on a tune spontaneously night after night. They can't do it. And in terms of musicianship, it's a deficiency in technique in jazz. So what was one of the things that inspired that? And that's one of the things I think that gives jazz its great strength. It's not just a bunch of people hacking around, you know, working on native instinct. It is highly sophisticated, highly refined discipline that makes all kinds of requirements on people, technical requirements, requirements of creativity, requirements of intellectual understanding. Now, it may not be university book learning, but the product, the end result, is highly, highly, highly sophisticated. So when people say jazz is America's classical music, it's not like, hey, you're kind of almost as good as classical music. No, you're jazz is the equivalent of the accomplishments of European jazz music. And by the way, when you read Jack's book, that's Jack Sullivan, who we interviewed for the podcast, and his book is called New Orleans Remix, you're going to hear that a lot of the great the great classical composers of the late 19th and 20th century all thought jazz was amazing, were inspired by it, created pieces influenced by it, and in Europe at least, looked at jazz as equal colleague, not as, this sort of quaint, second-tier music, but wow, these guys are great. These guys are amazing. We can learn stuff from them. So there's a great chapter, many great chapters in Jack's book, but the chapter on the intricate relationship of the New Orleans opera scene and the early days of jazz is revelatory. It's a really important thing. You can listen to the interview, you get Jack's book, but if you love jazz, you really should bone up on this fact of jazz history that has been obscured over time. Before we interviewed Jack, we interviewed John Gennari, who's a professor in Vermont, I believe at the University of Vermont. Forgive me, John, for not having that at my fingertips. He wrote a great book, I love it, called Flavor and Soul, Italian America and its African American Edge. And, you know, we have this tendency to look at history in boxes and look at people in boxes, and there's the Italians over there and the Afro-Americans over there, and they all were on separate tracks, and not true at all. Not true at all. And John breaks that down and tells the story of how Italian Americans were influenced by Afro-Americans culturally and creatively, and how Afro-Americans were in turn influenced by Italian Americans. There's a cultural sharing been going on for a long, long time. And again, we always bring up New Orleans because New Orleans is such a key place. But if you go back to New Orleans, the French Quarter was at the turn of the century, not Treme and not Uptown, but the French Quarter itself was largely Sicilian and Italian immigrants living there in those days. The first band to record with the word jazz on it was made up of Sicilian Americans. St. Joseph's Day, which is one of the sacred days in the New Orleans calendar when the Mardi Gras Indians come out, is a Italian, it's a Catholic feast day, but it's especially celebrated by Sicilians and Southern Italians. Why is one of the most iconic Afro-American cultural events held on the saint day of a Sicilian saint? I mean, not a Sicilian saint, but on a you know what I'm saying, Sicilian honored saint. How did that happen? So this is an important part of our history, and I think it adds, knowing these things add greatly to our appreciation and enjoyment of the music. That was something I brought up with Judy. I said, does food taste better when you know where the ingredients came from, who grew them, how they grew them, and how it was prepared in the kitchen? Does it taste better? I say it does, if it's made well. I say it's more interesting. I say it gives you more to reflect on and more to think about and more to search for when you're eating. And I think the same thing is true with music. Before we interviewed John, we interviewed Carol Bash, who made a great documentary called The Lady Who Swings the Band about the late, great, essential artist, totally underappreciated, Mary Lou Williams. Mary Lou Williams was playing, as a young lady, playing in the honky-tonks of Kansas City. I mean, you had to have grit as a man to do that, and for a young lady to do that and hold her own is unbelievable. And she was in hot demand as a composer and arranger. Duke Ellington used her stuff. Count Basie used her stuff. Benny Goodman hired her. She's a fantastic person. And if that wasn't enough, when young Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk and Dizzy Gillespie were coming up, Mary Lou was about 10 years older than them, had that extra 10 years of experience, they would come to her house. And we have photographs of that, by the way, on the podcast page for Carol, and hang out and learn theory. So Mary Lou Williams, a really important person, and we cast a light on her and her career through our interview with filmmaker Carol Bash, who made The Lady Who Swings the Band. Then we had a really cool interview with Urdresh Mahantapa, and he's got a hard name to say, and we joked that he should change it to Rudy Manhattan. But you know what? Frank Sinatra did not change his name to Frankie Satin. By the way, they asked him to change his name to Frankie Satin, and he responded with a four-letter word. Urdresh is not that kind of guy, but he's using his name as given by his family. It's a tough name, but in spite of having this difficult name, he has been recognized and acknowledged to be one of the great, great, great alto players and composers. And he's also a great educator and won the Downbeat Top Alto Player many years running. And the reason I want to talk with Urdresh is I wanted to talk about this whole process of becoming a jazz musician. I mean, you can see somebody growing up in the 20s and hearing jazz everywhere and sneaking into the clubs and getting a horn and getting invited to, you know, play at the nightly, you know, performance with the band and learning from the old time. You can see how people learn jazz that way. How the heck does a kid of Indian heritage growing up in Boulder, Colorado in the 1980s and 90s, how does he find his way in jazz? You know, and yet these kids, and I can say that because I'm older than Urdresh a little bit, these kids figure it out. And that's an exciting and thrilling thing, and it's something as jazz fans that we should be acutely interested in, and we should always be on the lookout for how we can support that process. In a sense, jazz musicians, they're going to crawl over broken glass naked to learn their art. They're going to do it whether they're helped or not, because they it's a compulsion. You know, that's one thing I've learned from all the musicians that I know. It's almost not a voluntary thing. You get that bug and it bites and you're in. But that doesn't say we can't help and we can't make it easier and we can't make opportunities available for young people, and we should be doing that. So we talked with Urdresh about that. We talked about his work at Princeton. Hats off to Princeton for having the intelligence to bring Urdresh down there to work on their program, jazz and music, and he's doing great stuff down there. So that's our one celebrity interview that we've done. Before that, we had an interview with Eve Zanny, and Eve is a singer. She's also a writer, and she's also creating children's books, has two out, one on Billie Holiday and one on Lester Young. And I think that's so great. You know, if kids are exposed to the music and they're exposed to the stories, they're exposed to the people, a percentage of them are going to be into it. But if you don't ever expose them, the chances of them developing a love for it are zero. Right? How can it happen if they're never exposed? So every bit of exposure that we can give them is a positive thing. And the existence of these books, which you can read about and hear about on the podcast with Eve. And I recommend everybody who has the means, buy these books and donate them to your local library. Why not? Why not? You never know what will happen. We may get the next Urdresh Mahantapa from a book that you put in your local library. But Eve tells another really important story, which is St. Peter's Church. I think that's the right name, on the Upper East Side. They occupied some really prime real estate. And the developer said, look, if you give us your lot, we'll let you stay there. We'll build you an amazing church, and we'll put a big office building on top of it. And that was a good deal for all concerned, and they went ahead and did it. And the pastor, and I'm sorry I don't remember his name. You're going to have to listen to the talk with Eve to get it, was a guy from Puerto Rico. That's a theme that's going to come up again and again, who loved the music. And he said, you know what, this music is so important, I'm going to personally support it and make it the mission of this church to support jazz. And one of the things they did was an annual commemoration of the life and work of Lester Young. And they did that every year. And people that knew Lester Young would come out and play in his honor, but also, as important, talk about their experiences with him. And I don't know. I always feel that Lester Young is not given his due. I think anybody that knows even a little bit about jazz eventually discovers there was a guy named Lester Young, and he was one of the many great players. But I think it's fair to say that if you take, as I said earlier, if you take Louis Armstrong out of the picture, the whole thing just falls apart. And I think the same thing is true of Lester Young. And I think one of the challenges for people to grasp that is he wasn't flashy. You know, Louis Armstrong was a great entertainer, and trumpet's kind of a flashy instrument, and he played it in a flashy way, and he lived a long time. You know, he had the opportunity to live out his days, and he was an extroverted guy, I think we can say that. And Lester Young was the opposite. He, you know, was a quieter guy, took opportunities to play, but didn't generally lead his own band. And then, of course, he died way too young. So I think part of the reason he's not fully acknowledged as he should be. But the other part of it, I think his music is so sophisticated that you almost have to be either a musician or a really serious listener. And you know what? You don't need musical training to be a serious listener. You just listen and listen and listen and listen again, and the music will reveal itself to you. So you don't have to be a musician. You don't have to have musical training. But you have to be kind of serious about music to understand the profundity of what he was doing. You know, there's all these artificial time, historical landmarks. You know, there was the ragtime era, and then there was the Dixieland era, and then there was the swing era, and then there was the bebop era and all that. You know, if bebop is playing super sophisticated harmonically sophisticated music super fast, Lester Young preceded bebop era by a good 10 years. And the truth is, when Charlie Parker was trying to figure out the saxophone, one of the things he did was take Lester Young solos, slow them down, and learn them. So there's just a tremendous amount of artistry there and innovation and genius, really. And I think part of the reason, another reason this goes to the flash element, is that he's so smooth with what he does that if you're not listening, you don't realize how slick it is. You know, it just sounds completely natural. It sounds like somebody just talking to you. But if you break it down, he was a phenomenal musician. So this idea of honoring Lester Young every year, the jazz community getting together to honor Lester Young every year was, and I have to say in the past tense, unfortunately, was a very important thing. St. Peter's recently, or not so recently, decided to discontinue it and just sort of broaden it to honor a different musician every year, which I think is also a great thing. But I think that the idea of jazz musicians getting together every year to take a close look at an appreciation of Lester Young is a very good thing. And I hope someday, somewhere, some organization will take that up, because it'll be a great thing. It'll be a great thing. The other thing that came up, and this has to do with time and funding, but many of those Lester Young days, commemorative days, were recorded. Some of them were filmed. All that stuff is sitting in Eve's closet. All it would take is time plus money to put that stuff out there for the world to see. And I guarantee it is some amazing, amazing, amazing stuff. There's nothing like musicians when they get together in a relaxed setting to honor one of their own. It is, you know, what was already good or great becomes super good or super great. The music goes to a whole nother level. And that's a theme that's come up a lot, and it bears repeating, is that the audience is a really essential part of the creation of the music. And an educated audience, an appreciative audience, an audience that's into it, makes a difference to the musicians and can make a difference to the quality of the music. And that's different. That's not how it is in pop music. That's not how it is in classical music, where everything's, you know, pre-written and formulated and programmed. When jazz musicians are on a stage, they can go in any one of a number of infinite directions within a form. And if they know people are listening, even if they know there's just one serious person out there listening, it brings something forth. So anyway, these tapes that Eve is sitting on of the Lester Young days, these are some treasures. You know, also speaking of treasures that are just locked up, because it's very time consuming. You know, there's nothing quick about any of this. Somebody's got to take the tape, digitize it, clean it up, post it to the internet, create a page. You know, we're talking many, many, many hours per tape. It's just, there's no, even though we live in the instant age of internet, it's instant to you, it's not instant on the other side. Verna Gillis has many, 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 many tapes of the work that she, the great work that she did. She had one of the most important jazz clubs in the history of jazz, bar none. It was over in the West 50s. I used to go. All kinds of amazing things would happen there. A lot of avant-garde music, great avant-garde music took place there. Soundscape. And such a great name. Such a great name for what she did at that club. Because it landscape, soundscape. And the other thing that she did was bring in Cuban musicians and give them a place to play. And she provided a home for Latin music. She also provided a home for various kinds of what's now called world music. Pioneer, real pioneer. And many, 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 many hours of tape exist, maybe some video too. And it could all be on the internet. It could all be accessible, but it takes time and money. So I'm throwing this out there in the hope that there's some deep-pocketed person who, with vision, who understands the significance of what I'm saying here. Before we interviewed Eve, we interviewed Jamie Abersold, and by coincidence, just as we're recording this, Jamie is beginning his final jazz summer camp, which he has been doing for many decades. If we do the numbers, it's very possible that Jamie Abersold has brought more people into the fold of improvising musicians than any living person on earth. And you, if you're a musician, you know his play-along series, and you know all the tools and materials and music that he's made available for aspiring musicians, but also professional musicians. He's many, many, many people who are pretty famous have copies of those play-along. But what is play-along? Play-along is you've got a drummer, a bass player, and a pianist or guitarist playing your rhythm section, and then you, the soloist, can just play over it while you're practicing, while you're rehearsing. Now, from a practical point of view, I don't know anybody that can afford to pick up the phone and say, hey guys, come on over, I feel like jamming. And that doesn't work that way. But with these play-along records, you can do that. You just pop in the CD. In the old days, it was a phonograph record. Then it became a cassette. And now it's a CD. And you can have a rhythm section and keep your chops up. And you'd be surprised at the people who continue to use those tools. And then you have the improvising summer camp, which has been going on for decades and decades and decades. It's one of the great institutions in jazz. A lot of great players got their first feeling of confidence in themselves and in their ability to learn to become improvising musicians at that camp. It's one of the great institutions. It would have been great if somebody could have been there and film. In fact, maybe I'll pop in the car and drive over to Indiana. I live in New York State. But it's almost worth it to go there and document this historic event. It's Jamie's last summer camp. I mean, wow. You know, wow. And what a great gentleman he is. It's so interesting. You know, he lives in southern Indiana. He was born there. He was raised there. He was educated there. And he's pretty much never left. I think he said he's only about a couple of blocks from the house where he was born. And people don't think of southern Indiana as a great jazz hotspot, but they really should in terms of the influence it's had on the development of the art. And it just also just goes to show you all the variety of human beings that come in, pour into this art form and make it what it is. Speaking of that, before we interviewed Jamie, we interviewed Carl Gerhard, and we talked about, and Carl was a leader of the Navy band program. And that, interestingly enough, you know, in the military, they have different designations. You know, you're a driver, you're a medic, you're this, you're that. And one of the earliest designations in the U.S. Navy, going all the way back to the 1700s, was musician. So this is a little told story, and it's an important story of how important this institution of the armed forces in general, but the Navy in particular, has been in the development of jazz. Musicians need opportunities to learn. They need opportunities to play. And one of the ways to get those learning opportunities and playing opportunities is through the armed forces. And we, because Carl's from the Navy, we spoke in particular about the Navy. And, you know, John Coltrane, he was playing bebop in Hawaii as a 20-year-old, as a, you know, 20-something-year-old, as a Navy man. He played in the band, and in their free time, as these musicians do, they learned the other stuff, and thank God somebody recorded it. Tito Puente, Navy guy. And he, when he got out of the Navy after World War II, thanks to the GI Bill, he was able to go to Juilliard. And that's where he learned all about arranging and orchestration. And Clark Terry, another example. Navy was absolutely critical in his career and artistic development. So that was a really fun interview with Carl. And Carl plays every night. He lives in Newport. He continues to teach. I think he's retired, but he can, you know, he's RET, but he continues to teach at the Naval College there. And he gigs, I think, every Thursday, but you'll have to listen to the podcast to figure out when. And I recommend that you drop by. Then we interviewed Howard Mandel, veteran jazz journalist, and we talked about all things related to the issues of documenting the scene. He is the leader of Jazz Journalists Association, or the Association of Jazz Journalists, and you'll have to look up the podcast to get the exact date, the exact name. But, you know, the people that write about jazz are really important too. They advise us about things that we otherwise might not discover. They give us things to think about. They give attention to musicians and music that deserves attention. And so we had a nice talk with Howard. Before that, we talked with John Ernesto, who is the driving force behind one of the most interesting jazz festivals on earth, the Berks Jazz Fest in southeastern Pennsylvania. It is a community organized event. In other words, the whole community gets involved. It is not one of these things where they hire, you know, Run DMC and Billy Joel and Bruce Springsteen and then have a couple of jazz acts, which is what's happening to a lot of jazz festivals these days. And nothing against those guys. It's just they're not jazz musicians. They're not playing jazz. Berks Jazz Fest, pure jazz, blues, and gospel, which is a very important element of jazz music. Take the gospel out of jazz. You know, take the opera and the gospel and the blues out of jazz and the habanera, the Latin tinge. That's, I can't think of the guy's name. The most famous jazz musician in the world. He called himself the originator of jazz. It'll come to me later. But anyway, you take all those things out of jazz, gospel, blues, the habanera rhythm, the Latin tinge, and you don't have jazz anymore. it doesn't exist. So you got to have. It's always good to throw a little gospel music into a jazz festival. Anyway, the Berks Festival is huge. It's passed this year. You have to go next year. They attract great musicians, and I think it's a great model for jazz festivals because everybody gets involved. All the hotels, all the restaurants. Everybody in that community wants to make that regional festival a big success. And it attracts tens of thousands of people every year. So it's very interesting to talk with John about that. Then, speaking of southeastern PA, we also had a conversation with Lewis Marks. And he runs a really interesting label that operates on a completely different model. It's called Rope-A-Dope Records. And in their model, they acknowledge that the artist should be in the driver's seat. The artists know what they're doing. Let the artists produce what they think is worth producing. And the role of a record label is to assist in the promotion and distribution, not to get involved in, hey, I think you need an extra saxophone there. You know, none of that nonsense. Letting the artists bring their best work forward and then doing for the artists what's frankly hard for many artists to do for themselves, which is the business side and the promotion side and the distribution side. But leaving the artists free to create what they want to create. And our point of departure was an album that came out that they just released from Eddie Palmieri. And Eddie recorded this album, and it's a great album. And, you know, where does this great 80-year-old patriarch of the music get commercial attention? You know, it's not easy. But thanks to the existence of Rope-A-Dope, this album got great promotion and great distribution. Before we talk with Lewis, we talk with Michelle Rosewoman. Fantastically fascinating human being. Grew up in Oakland, has a deeply rooted into Afro-American music. Also, deeply rooted into Afro-Cuban music. She got both of those streams at an early age from a very rich and creative music scene in Oakland. And, of course, she brought that to New York. She is beloved by so many serious musicians. She's a great composer, great band leader, great pianist, and she is doing some of the absolute most interesting work in blending the American, the North American approach to music with the Cuban and the Afro-Caribbean approach to music. And it's not a casual blending. It's not just, hey, let's throw in a bongo drum here. It is really deep and interesting and fascinating work, and I'm glad we had a chance to interview her. Before that, we interviewed Tomas Pena, and the title of that call was The Best Kept Secret in Jazz, Puerto Ricans Master Musicians. And this is a hugely important topic, especially today where our fellow American citizens in Puerto Rico have basically been left to hang out and dry. We now know that the death toll was not 60 people. It's over 4,000. And I'm going to guess when the true numbers come in, it will be over 10. Horrible, horrible stain on our country's history and character that we couldn't get it together to bring sufficient relief to our own countrymen. And one of the things we talked about in this call, and we're still not doing it, by the way, at the time of this recording, which is in June of 2018, why we are able to fly 20 gazillion trillion dollars worth of material to Iraq or Afghanistan or any of these other places, and we can't fly it to an island that is, you know, a couple of hours from Florida, I just think is a disgrace. It almost doesn't need to be said, but it's so obvious, but maybe we need to be saying it and we need to be talking about it. Anyway, in this call with Tomas, we talk about the amazing contributions of Puerto Ricans to jazz. You know, the very original band, John Rhys Europe, Europe Rhys, I always get that mixed up. But this was the first great Afro-American band that went to Europe. This is the band that opened the eyes of Europe to the great creative things that were happening in the United States. You know, there was no financial possibility for Afro-Americans to get together and go to Europe and play previous to this. So this World War I made it necessary for military bands to be formed, and they gave control over one of these bands to one of the great American musicians of all time, and he recruited the very best musicians he could find. And where did he go for his clarinet section? And I think he brought 14 musicians in his band. He had to go to Puerto Rico to find them, because the training available in Puerto Rico was at a very, very high level. And that, so at the very, very roots, the very, very beginning of this music, you had Puerto Rican musicians on the bandstand, holding it down. And it just goes on and unacknowledged to this day. And so we could talk about the situation in Puerto Rico all day, but I think one of the small steps that we can take in helping address that situation is to at least let our fellow jazz fans know that Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans are important, and they have always been in every era. Juan Tizol, Puerto Rican. He was the musical director of Duke Ellington's band during some of Duke's most creative periods. He wrote some of the great jazz classics. Tito Puente, integrating Latin music with jazz. Puerto Rican. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Those are just the marquee names. There's hundreds, thousands of musicians of Puerto Rican ancestry who've made incalculably important contributions to the music. And so Tomas and I talked about that. Then I talked with Robert Wagner, who does an amazing project. There's so many people out there doing beautiful, beautiful work in the documentation of jazz, and I think Robert's work is right up there with the best of it. It's called artistsofjazz.com. And Robert is a veteran New York film cameraman, you know, and I have a friend that's in this roughly the same generation as him, and those guys are good at what they do. They came up when you had to load the film by hand and cut it by hand, and you know, there were no weak people in that industry when that was all film. You really had to have your stuff together to be in it and stay in it and excel. And Robert's been in it for decades, and he's made all the adaptations to video and electronics and digital and so on, but he's rooted in that original tradition, and he's a great artist, a great craftsman. And what he does on his own dime is he goes out and he interviews, he gets quality, beautiful, beautifully shot, beautifully conceived, just beautiful. And you know, I'm looking at some, here's, I'm going to give you a quick fast list. Dr. Lonnie Smith, Kenny Barron, Aaron Scott, Bill Saxton, Bertha Hope. And I'm very happy to say, proud to say, that Jazz on the Tube hooked Bertha up with the Artists of Jazz project. Albert Tudy Heath, Bernard Purdy, Norman Simmons, Curtis Lundy, Lenny White, Annie Ross, Ubi Green, Richard Wyans, Stanley Cowell, Billy Harper, Larry Willis, Hemiot Blewett, Rufus Reed, George Coleman, Lou Tabakan, Toshiko Akiyoshi, Sonny Fortune, Oliver Lake, one of my favorites always, Victor Lewis, Cranshaw, George Cables, Chuck Israels, Paul West, Lee Konitz, Leroy Williams, Sheila Jordan, John Hendricks, Barry Harris, Andrew Cyril. You getting the idea? And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And these are beautiful, beautifully crafted interviews. Some of these are big, quote, big names. Some of them are people deserve big names, don't have them. And some of the people that have been interviewed in this series have never been interviewed this way before in their entire careers. So this is very important work that Robert's doing. And this is one of the many occasions where I'm happy that Jazz on the Tube exists, and I'm happy that the podcast exists, because you know, we were able to give some promotion to this work. You probably never heard of it before. I never heard of it before. This is really, really great work, and it's called artistsofjazz.com. So couldn't do all 50 of the shows. I did maybe 20 of them. I don't know, 15 of them. But you get a flavor for what we've been doing. I'm going to take a breather. We have a lot of technical things to learn and to master if we want to syndicate this program correctly. It's not rocket science, but for me, it's rocket science. You know, I know for some people, it's like falling off a log. For me, it's going to take weeks of effort to make it all work. But we're trying to create a system so that when we do a new interview, it'll be syndicated over all kinds of internet podcast directories. And apparently, this makes it a lot easier for people to find the work, and it makes a lot easier for people to consume the work. And I want to thank everybody who's written in and recommend it and encouraged me to make that step. But until that step is made, we're going to just put a little vacation on here. That's why I wanted to go over some of the most recent work we've done. You probably haven't heard every single podcast we've done, but you know what? You can. They're all there. They're all available. And they are really, really worth listening to if you love jazz and want to get deeper into it. So thank you for listening to this long ramble. I hope you found it somewhat illuminating. Thank you to all of our supporters. We absolutely depend on you now. The advertising environment on the internet has changed radically. We are now only making 20%, not 20% less, only 20% of what we used to make, which is making it harder, you know, because the expenses have not, well, we have figured out ways to trim expenses, but believe me, we could not trim our cash outlow 80%. We couldn't figure out how to do that. We're running as tight and as lean as we possibly can. Much of the effort, many, many hundreds of hours every year are donated to this project, which is fine, but it would be nice to have more supporters. So if you're not a supporter yet, I want to strongly encourage you to consider it. You know, consider this a user fee, a voluntary user fee. We give this away. We don't ask anybody to pay because we don't know. Maybe somebody's in Cameroon, you know, at a little internet cafe in a small town in Africa, and he's interested. Okay, we don't want to tell that guy he's got to pay $10. That may be a whole month's salary there, you know. So we want to make this. First part of this is to make it good, to make it big, you know, to have as many different things on it as possible. But a very important part of it is to make it free. But free to you doesn't mean free to us. And if you're lucky enough to have resources beyond what you need to survive, you know, this might be a place to put some of them. Honestly, I don't know. It depends on how much you love the music and how much you care that other people find it and can appreciate it. So, but anyway, to those that are supporting and have supported in the past, thank you very much. To those that are thinking about it, really do it, you know, just do it. Take advantage of these podcasts. Nobody's doing this kind of work. I can't say that anymore. Judy is doing similar but different work. She has a different emphasis than we, but it's coming from the same place. We want to promote the music. We want to promote understanding. We want to promote appreciation. And we want to make sure that people realize this is not one of those celebrity things where if somebody's got a big name, they're immediately worthy of attention. And if somebody doesn't have a big name, they're not worthy of anything. Well, that's not how jazz works. We are independent people, all of us. We have our own ears. We have our own intelligence. When somebody's up around on the bandstand, doesn't matter where they came from, what their name is, what their pedigree is, it's completely irrelevant. It's all an issue of what they can put out. And if they can put it out, we honor them. And that's the spirit of which we're doing what we're doing. So thanks. Have a great summer. I'm going to be back as soon as all these other things are sorted out. And in the meantime, take advantage of all the amazing podcasts that you can hear on Jazz on the Tube. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.